time. Especially nice and
slow. Engage. Brain before mouth. Hmm? That's what they say. This is a third Naman Talks, a series of interviews with personalities in the HCI, that is human-computer interaction, or the user-centered domain, with ideas worth looking into. My name is Johannes van der Meulen of Naman, and today, that's the 30th of January 2007, we're having Dr. Yvonne Rogers, HCI Chair at Open University. Welcome, Yvonne. Thank you for coming.
And thank you for inviting me here to Brussels.
First, I'd like to say a little bit about Yvonne from my perspective. Those who've been working in the domain of interaction design or human-computer interaction probably know the textbook by Sharp, Rogers and Preece. Well, Yvonne is Rogers in that book, and there is a second edition, was published a few days ago, so look it up on Amazon. It's called Interaction Design. And the authors are still the same, three?
We alternate them. So it was Preece, Rogers and Sharp. And now it's Sharp, Rogers and Preece. So, and then the next one, the third edition, I'll be first. But it's Sharp, yes.
Here at Naman, we also know Yvonne through a paper she wrote in 2004. In the annual review of information science and technology, which was titled New Theoretical Approaches for HCI. We're not going to talk about that now, but it was very inspiring in how it indicated the problems, the issues with the large gap between theory, HCI theory, and HCI practice. Before we continue with ubiquitous computing, could you give me some background on where you're coming from?
Yeah, I have a background in human-computer interaction and cognitive science. I did my PhD back in the 80s looking at graphical representations, and then after completing that, I got a job in industry working for a telecommunications company called Alcatel that looked at new kinds of interfaces for their products. And then they decided to close down their research lab, so I returned to academia, where I have worked in a number of universities, including Sussex, and also I have worked in the States at Indiana University, and have spent time at Stanford and UCSD as a visiting professor.
That's San Diego?
Yes, that's in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And I have been looking at how you can design a variety of technologies ranging from multimedia to virtual reality to tangible interfaces, and now to looking at ubiquitous computing, how you can design these for a range of activities from learning to decision-making to collaborative activities. So my research is very much grounded in thinking about the design of the representations and how we might interact with them. So that's where I'm coming from.
For the sake of a good understanding by everyone, can you give a description of ubiquitous computing and what it represents exactly in your mind?
Okay, I guess I'll give you two definitions. One, which is a vision that Mark Visor, who's considered to be the father of ubiquitous computing, and how he described what it would be like or should be like. And then I will describe what's become known as Ubicomp, which is the field of ubiquitous computing in the 21st century. And so if I can begin, Mark Visor was a research scientist at Xerox PARC, and he wrote a very influential paper in the Scientific American called The Computer for the 21st Century, where he laid out what was his vision of ubiquitous computing that he called calm technology.
This was early 90s, right?
Yes, this was in 91. And he said that computers are going to become ubiquitous in the sense they're going to become embedded in our environments and they're going to be everywhere. And that what he was concerned with is that these computers, which could range from small tabs to large displays that could be in our homes, our offices, and the outside world, was that they better not overburden us. They better not get, you know, in our ways. But can we start thinking about how to design them so that they disappear into the environment when we don't need them and then reappear when we need them? So he started to think about how this technology could just appear when we as humans needed them. And he talked about going from the periphery to the center of attention. And what he had a vision of was this idea where we would glide through life and that it would be calm, information would appear. For example, if there was a traffic jam ahead when we were driving along, it would warn us beforehand such that we could, so that we could decide to take a diversion and get a cup of coffee and wait for the traffic congestion to disappear so that we would never get frustrated. And we could also find information about what was happening in our neighborhood when and where we needed it. And so in his picture of ubiquitous computing, he tried to envision how the different technologies could be designed and used to enable people to have these serene and calm lives. So that's the vision. And it inspired a lot of researchers moving into this field, thinking about how they could design environments that were intelligent, that could somehow measure what people were doing, and then to be able to model that, and then to be able to provide them with contextually aware or relevant information in a variety of contexts. In particular, there have been research looking at how context-aware computing could be used in the home and in hospitals and other settings. One of the biggest problems that researchers have found, however, is that it's really difficult to somehow measure what people are doing, what their wants are and what their needs are, and to then be able to provide appropriate or relevant information, even for some of the most simplest of activities. So, for example, one of the earliest projects was looking at mobile phones and working out when to switch them off depending on what context you were in. So if you were in a meeting, would it know that during that meeting it wasn't appropriate for it to be on the ringtone? And just working out what the context is for these really simple settings has proven to be quite hard. There are a number of other examples where projects have tried to predict the emotional state of people. But again, people are very variable, and so it's been very hard to try and come up with models of human behavior and human emotion.
Because there is so much context. Yes. There's the humans, there's the culture, there's a particular situation, there's the time of day. There are just too many variables, it appears, to do anything, that's what you're saying, to do anything productive and useful with it. And so it is not calm anymore, and the vision is not realized.
Yes.
Okay. So where does that then take us? I mean, should we then not have this a utopian vision of technology, and should we be pessimistic? Or can you propose another vision on ubiquitous computing, but maybe more realistic, but maybe also more appropriate?
I think, yes, this raises two questions as to whether ubiquitous computing, in terms of this calm technology vision, is realizable. Do we have the knowledge and the capability of doing this type of modeling? And secondly, is it desirable? Do we want to live in this world that where everything is serene and calm? Isn't it? Sometimes it's quite nice to feel uncomfortable or to have a little frustration. It keeps us on our toes. But if we just glided through life and never got angry or never had cause to be frustrated, I think it would be a very different world. And I also think it's be very unrealistic.
Mm-hmm. Many examples of these visions portrayed in videos. You've talked about the Hewlett-Packard video. Apple has, I think it's called the Navigator, and Vodafone has an interesting one as well. What drives these companies to produce these kind of visions?
I think they are very useful as vehicles for communication and for presenting ideas of how the future might be, which can be very accessible and engaging and get people thinking straight away, is this what we want? Is this the kind of world where we should be putting all our energies, designing technologies? Or is there something fundamentally wrong about the human values that are being supported and so forth? And so, for example, in the video Cool Town, which Hewlett Packard developed.
Cool Town.
Cool Town as
yes. Okay.
Being cool.
Right.
It presented many scenarios of where these ubiquitous technologies would be highly beneficial, from helping young children learn a foreign language to helping old people who might have fallen over and detecting this and getting the emergency people there to deal with the situation. I think are basically altruistic, and they show in a very good light. But sometimes they can be unrealistic and also dangerous. And so one of the scenarios that was presented in Cool Town was having information displayed on a car windscreen as the person was driving along, so they could read their emails literally. And this, you know, if you're driving along, the last thing you want to be doing is reading emails at the same time. As we well know, that it's banned in the UK, I'm not sure in Brussels, to be using your mobile phone at the same time as driving.
Absolutely banned unless you use a headset.
Yes.
Which doesn't appear to make a big difference, but...
Back to your question, I think they always present a utopian view of the future, and it's there to inspire researchers. But I've found that it also provokes students in particular to thinking about what's wrong with this vision and why it's unrealistic or it's never going to happen.
Well, there's inevitably a technology push element in it, which is understandable, and you know, and the visions are laudable. It's always fun to look at them, and looking at the HP Cool Town video, what could be wrong with all that? But indeed, I think you indicated the difficulty of capturing the contextual data. Could you enter into some detail on problems in capturing contextual information and making taking relevant conclusions from them?
Let me give you an example from another research project, which was run by IBM, called Blue Eyes. And they had great aspirations to develop intelligent environments that could predict what kind of information you wanted at a given point, whether it be at home or at work. And their assumption was that this would make you more efficient and more effective in your everyday and working activities. And so they used computer vision and a number of artificial intelligence techniques to try and, first of all, capture your behavior, activities, and developed a number of algorithms to try and then analyze what you were doing and to then decide what information might be appropriate. However, this was very complicated, and they really didn't succeed in achieving their goals. And let me give you an example of where what they tried to do was to predict what you might want happening when you were sitting at home in your living room. And so depending on where you were looking, it would predict that you might want that technology to be switched on. So, for example, if you were looking at the TV, the cameras would pick that up, and then it would deduce that you wanted the TV switching on. This is a really simple activity, and but if you then try and scale up to thinking about, well, you might be just looking up into thin air when you're thinking about something. How does the system know that that's what you're doing, rather than you're looking at the ceiling asking for the lights to be switched on or off? And so even from the most simplest of activities, it is incredibly difficult to infer.
For fear of appearing technophobic, if these computers are going to be all over the place anyway, and that's happening clearly, should I then not become calm in the sense of a visor? Should I become loud? Or how should I then be positioned towards, you know, in human society in a way? What should their role be? What etiquette should they respect?
Well, I think since Pfizer wrote his paper in 91, the technologies have really developed. And so mobile technologies like the mobile phone have become ubiquitous. Everyone carries one or two of these around, PDAs. And so we do have information at our fingertips, although it's not necessarily seamless. We have to pull it out of our pocket and disrupt the ongoing activity. And so I think technologically we have these developments. Certainly, I would argue that it's far from calm. If you've ever been on a train in Britain when it's full of people on their mobile phones, I would argue that that is not calm at all. It's very annoying and very frustrating.
If you're not talking yourself.
Yes. And so my argument or my suggestion is to perhaps not think about using the, or perhaps not think about how these technologies can be designed to be calm, but to think about how we can design ubiquitous computing in a different way. And it might be to be more engaging and more exciting, and also to augment what we currently do and to think of them as tools to support our everyday activities. And so my own research, which is part of the Equator IRC, that is an ongoing research project in the UK, has been to look at how we can design novel technologies to support learning, which is exciting, provocative and playful. And so what we've done has been to take these different technologies and to put them into a physical environment. In this case, it was a woodland. And to provide pairs of children with a variety of mobile and ubiquitous devices to discover more about that wooded area and to be able to make inferences themselves about what's going on and what they're discovering, rather than the environment doing it for them. And so what we're trying to do is to get, in this case, children, but also adults, more actively involved in their everyday activities through the use of these technologies.
Not look at computers as omniscient, an omniscient presence which tries to deduce what you're up to, but really put the human in the center of it all, where it becomes a tool. Just, you know, the old paradigm where you know, computers are tools and that's it, and they don't envelop you in...
I think what we, our approach is to just follow on from the same model of the PC, which is to think of it as a tool by which you use it to augment the human intellect or to extend the ways in which you can currently do problem solving or decision making, and not to envision this world where all of these technologies are interconnected and they take over the decision making of human beings. Which perhaps, you know, can be seen as a part of this vision of calm technology.
When I was a little boy, I had a plan which I never realized. I was going to build a model, a mock-up of the home of my parents, and I would. This is 30 years ago, I was going to put in sensors at each of the doors, and then I would be able to see on this model which door is open and who's moving where, right? This is a very boy vision, an engineering vision. Is there anything about the demographic here, about male engineering control on the one hand, and female approach to this domain? Does that play in any way, you think?
I don't think it's a gender thing, but certainly there are researchers who are fascinated with what you can do using sensor technology, and if you can place it in the home, how it might be able to measure doors opening and so forth. And that brings me to a project that was carried out in the States, where they tried to wire up a residential care home for the elderly. And their reasons for doing so was just to improve the health care that these patients got, so that you could detect their every movements and what they were up to, And then be able to intervene more effectively at appropriate times. And so what they did was they put switches on doors, just like you wish to do in your own home, and then they put what are called active badges on the patients and the carers, so they could detect where they were, in which room they were in the building and also outdoors. And they also put load sensors onto the beds. And the reason for putting load sensors on was to find out how much weight the elderly people were putting on or losing. And because this is very important, that sometimes, you know, old people would start to lose weight without it being noticed. And they wanted to be able to intervene at the appropriate time. However, I don't know if you know, but load sensors can detect weight at any time of the day. And so what it also enabled them to do was discover who else might be getting in bed with these various elderly people. And this raises enormous questions to do with privacy. In particular, do these elderly people want their every movement and also others being recorded and monitored by their carers, but also their family? Is this the kind of thing that we should be moving towards?
Mm-hmm. Well, the privacy issues are indeed enormous here. I have a feeling that over the last few years, users understand that they're going to have to give away some of their privacy in order to get certain benefits, such as I don't mind having cameras on the main square in my city because I will feel safer as well, that kind of trade-off. Do you think that in the case of the elderly homes, it could be a question of choice that you can say, okay, no, I don't mind being monitored like this, or I can switch it on or off? Would that be a good solution?
Yeah, I think the way forward is not to sort of say, right, we're not going to have any of this technology in the home and sort of take a Luddite approach, but to involve or engage the people that are going to be monitored. And so in this case, it will be the elderly. And so they could come up with some sort of agreement that the sensing might be switched off at certain times in the day or the evening. But they are participating in the design of this environment and such that they can feel comfortable. And also that they are more aware of where the information is going, who is observing it. And so I think perhaps that's one way forward is to involve or engage the people that are being monitored.
Thank you, Yvonne, for spending this time with us. It was very interesting. Thank you for coming over and having this talk about ubiquitous computing, and good luck.
Thank you very much, too.